Okay, time once again for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy here on Residence 104.4 London as we count down the hours to the royal wedding.
Honey, are you really concerned about the royal wedding?
Concerned? Excited. I'm excited. The betrothal of Prince William and Madeline Konchalski.
Honey, I read on the Huffington Post that virginity is no longer a requirement in a royal bride.
Really? Why, they can't afford the guy who does the proper testing anymore? The Buckingham Palace is bankrupt like everybody else?
No, Buckingham Palace in this day and age is part of the oligarchy class, which does well under quantitative easing and massive inflation and destruction of the peasant class.
Kate Middleton, that's her name. So, yeah, I saw a disturbing video last week. I posted it to maxkaiser.com. It was some American, woman in London teaching boys and girls how to curtsy and behave properly in front of royalty. You just wanted to smack her in the face with a wet trout. Say, wake up, you freaking tyrannical, red coat loving, you know, tyrant, backstabbing, turncoat. What the heck, man? This is not what we're supposed to be doing. This is the enemy, basically.
Did you ever see the Borat thing where he went to one of these sort of how to act proper people, this minor aristocrat who taught lessons and how to behave properly? And he did a lot of rude things, of course, like disappear from the table for a very long time. After asking to use the bathroom, the toilets, and he returned saying, "Oh, I took a massive dump. It was really good. It was very good." And the woman was like, "We don't speak about that at the table."
Yeah, well, you know, Emily Post and all these people who make a business and refining young ladies and young aristocrats in the fine art of kissing schnozzle. You know, here's a tip. When you're at the dinner table with a bunch of bankers and the fork is on the left-hand side of the plate, grasp that with your left hand, then switch it to your right hand, and then poke the banker in the eye. That's the most, genial way of blinding a frickin' terrorist banker. What was that big pop? I don't know. There's someone storming the door.
They're trying to break in, Max.
Well, I've got triple reinforcements now. They can't break in. It's all good here in the bunker.
Anyway, so there are two things. You actually brought up the royal wedding, and I see that.
Yeah, I sure did. Like a bad vomit in the back of my throat.
No, I see that they're issuing some sort of silver coin or gold coin over in Canada.
It's counterfeit. It's got some nonsensical blue sapphire to embed it in this. It's counterfeit. It's counterfeit. It's not pure silver. It's junk silver. Yeah, it's not. It's made out of tin. Actually, it's. They grind up old Coca-Cola, tin cans. And it's not worth the plum nickel. I mean, you buy a silver Kaiser, that's pure silver.
Well, I saw a friend of ours finally broke down, and he has been inspired to go buy some silver. And he bought a bunch of Australian silver coins. And it is pretty shocking to see the Queen on Australian coins. Or Prince William on Canadian coins. It is that weird vestige of empire that just seems so bizarre, really, in this day and age.
Yeah, they're paying 39 euros an ounce. 39 euros an ounce. So, what's that? How many? That's 44, 8, 16.
$55, maybe?
$56 an ounce. Silver closed at 40.70 or so, just under $41 an ounce, up, I think it was 6% for the week. It's up 100% in the past, I don't know, year or so. I mean, it's just skyrocketing and it's zooming higher once the price gets above the price of JP Morgan stock. JP Morgan stock is around 47. So J.P. Morgan has collateralized its own stock to finance the short sales against silver in the futures markets and the over-the-counter derivative markets. So once price of silver gets over 47, then you should start to see massive shorting of J.P. Morgan stock by hedge fund managers who would be shorting the stock and naked shorting the stock. And you start to see some worry about J.P. Morgan. Now, everyone says, well, J.P. Morgan, you know, they're in trouble. The government's just going to bail them out. Well, great, because they'll use more fiat money to do so, which, of course, will drive the price of silver even higher. So I don't get that argument. That was once again made this past week by Jim Willey that, they're just backed by the government. Yeah, so was the Fed. So was J.P. Morgan. So was Wall Street. So was the whole corrupt system. As it's collapsing, they issue more paper, more money, more credit. And that's what's driving silver higher. The argument makes no sense. So far, I think I've been proven correct on this because they raised the margin requirement. They raised the position limits. They're jawboning about how J.P. Morgan is impenetrable. All that stuff has not stopped the price of silver from skyrocketing again this past week, and it will continue to do so. When it gets over the $50 all-time high per ounce, then it's off to the races. Then we're going to start to see gaps up to the $60, $70, $80 price level pretty quickly.
You know what else is gapping up is oil. That was up over 2% on Friday, and I don't know what it is in British pound terms, but I know that just last week it hit an all-time high in pound terms, even higher than when it was $147, mm-hmm. because the pound has crashed so much since then,
yeah.
even against the dollar. But we seem to be in this vortex, of inescapable vortex. So when people like Jim Willey say, oh, J.P. Morgan could be bailed out by the government. Well, CNBC, Bloomberg, Financial Times, all of these like financial press are even noting this vortex of the dollar, and that the Fed is having to print more and more money to keep the U.S. from drowning. But as the price of oil is skyrocketing, all of these Arab nations have huge reserves just building up in these otherwise deflationary times. So they have more money than they could possibly spend. They're, of course, spending it trying to keep their populations from rising up, but they still have a lot of reserves that they're trying to get rid of some of the dollars just because they have so many of them that they're buying euros. And this is also in turn driving Asia, which needs to keep their balance. They have strict balance on currency reserves. So because the Middle East buying so many euros to try to offset the inflow of massive amounts of dollars, that's driving the dollar down further, which is causing the Asian countries to have to buy more euros. So you see that we're in a vortex that it could at any moment spin out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, that's a good breakdown of the euro, the Middle East oil dollar, and the U.S. dollar, and what we're seeing, the ebb and flow around the world as the dollar continues to deteriorate. And the fact is that all of this cross-trading and carry trading and massive $3 trillion per day Forex market has been going on and building for decades, but the net result to the average American is that their price of food and energy has been cheap relative to the rest of the world. So they never paid any attention. So now, finally, with the price of gas in the U.S. breaking $5 a gallon shortly and energy prices zooming higher, suddenly, Americans are waking up that there's a big bad world out there, and the big bad world is selling dollars. And so they're just waking up to this fact that $3 trillion per day Forex market, this means that the entire U.S. economy is rolled over every 5 or 6 days. Every 4 or 5 days, the entire capitalization of the entire United States economy is turned over in the Forex market. That's how big the Forex market is. And the forces that drive that market are driven by folks whose interests have nothing to do with any of the individual countries that are seeing their economies rock and roll as a result of all this trading, which brings me to George Soros, who was in the news this past week talking about Bretton Woods II. So as we've been predicting on this show for a number of years, the resolution of all of these problems will be a new Bretton Woods-type conference, a new architecture will emerge for the global currency grid, and a new global central bank and a new global currency based on the special drawing right will be the new law of the land. And the various countries will have to concatenate their underlying currencies into the new supercurrency, like we saw with the euro, created from the various European countries blending their individual sovereign currencies into the new euro. This will happen now on a global basis, and the various trading zones will blend up to this new global currency. And the U.S. dollar is going to take a massive hit because it's got too much debt. In order to write off the debt that the U.S. has, and they've got $50, $60, or $70 trillion worth of debt, depending on how you account for it, to write off that debt, they're going to have to take a 50 to 60% hit in the dollar, which means that prices in the U.S. are going to be up 50 to 60% in one move, and this will be crushing, of course, to the economy, but there's no recourse for the citizens at this point. They have no way to fight back.
Well, I predict, however, that they will expand. They'll make sure there are food stamp credit cards for the people, because they'll have to be like the Saudi king. Even this like absolute dictator ruler of the Saudi king has to spend money or quell the population. So I think they'll have to. I think how they'll keep the population from being too revolutionary in America will be food stamps, widespread issuance of food stamps. And we know now with all the technology, however, that they can monitor exactly your movements with these credit card technologies. And therefore, if you do become a troublemaker in a Tahrir Square sort of way, they will cut off your food stamp card.
Yeah, well, this is exactly what happened in France in 1715 with John Law, who brought in the fiat currency. It happened in 1789 after the French Revolution, where they brought back again the fiat money. What happens is that the population starts to demand that the government print more paper currency because prices keep going higher, so they need more paper currency to buy stuff that they can't afford, and it creates this vicious cycle. And it causes hyperinflation and a collapse. And you're right, the people in America will demand that their food stamp allotment increases every month, even though this is driving the price of food and energy higher, and this is a hyperinflationary currency collapse. By the way, speaking of hyperinflation and currency collapse, you know, going back a few years now, the question was always, would the U.S. and global economy experience deflation, inflation, stagflation, or hyperinflation? And up until maybe a year ago, it looked like stagflation was in the cards, which is to say prices for food and energy going higher, but wages going lower, stagnating or going lower. So as we saw in the 1970s, stagflation. But now it looks like actually we're going to head into hyperinflation, which is currency collapse. And we see evidence of this right now with the dollar. If you notice, Stacey, on Friday, it closed under 75 on the dollar index, the most widely quoted index for the dollar. As you pointed out, all these other currencies are hitting new highs. The Australian dollar is 105 against the dollar. I think that's a new high I've ever seen.
Yeah, something close to that on the Canadian dollar as well. And even the euro is up against the dollar. And this is in a week that Portugal has had to go to the euro ECB for a massive bailout.
Mm-hmm. Swiss franc also at 110 versus the dollar.
Oh, my God.
So these currencies are zooming higher. And this is the related to the total loss of confidence in the U.S. dollar. And it's a...
Well, I saw in this Vortex article, basically, I was talking about on CNBC, where they're saying, why does nobody love the dollar? And they did interview some currency, some Forex guys, and they said, you know, we keep on getting this wrong. We keep on saying that it has to turn around. It has to turn around because we've never seen anything like this, that the euro could be soaring so much and the Swiss franc, like, it just seems unbelievable. But they said, you know, we've just basically stopped calling it because it doesn't seem to have an end right now.
Yeah, well, so there have been a lot of chatter because in 2008, there was a massive, you know, what Peter Schiff calls the fake dollar rally as the economy went into the tank and there was a move into dollars. Dollars traded higher. During that period, actually, during the crisis, I believe this dollar index got down to around 71. It's currently at around 74 and change. But then it had this move up to high 80s, close to 90 as part of this unwinding of all these various positions. And, you know, up in even all year, so far in 2011, every single week, there's been, you know, high-profile pundits saying the dollar is oversold, the unwinding is here, there's a flight to the dollar, and it's just not materializing. And it reminds me of, you know, 1987, in August of 1987, in the summer of 1987, the Dow Jones Industrial Average peaked out at around, I think it was around 3,600 or so. And it started to sell off. And it sold off all throughout August and throughout September and in the beginning of October. And for week after week after week, there's that mantra, buy the dip, buy the dip. Market's going higher, market's going higher. And it lost 10 or 15 or 20% before the crash of 1987. Then on Monday, October 19th, he had an actual 22% crash.
Yeah.
And but the market had already been selling off for weeks and weeks and weeks.
But that's not possible today, right? You couldn't have a 22% crash in the Dow because of the they shut it down, right? Is that correct?
Well, they try to impose what they call collars, which are borrowed from the futures markets, where they basically would have limit up, limit down on the S&P futures, etc. But it's untested. You know, in my opinion, it has not been adequately tested. So I can't really say, and I don't believe that it would be enough of a barrier to contain a meltdown. But the problem with stocks, stocks are being bought up as the bond market collapses, because this is more where the risk lies. It's not really in the stock market, but more in the bond market, because the bond market is the foundation of the entire global economy, and all these 0% interest rates, zero interest rate policy that's been going on for years now has attracted trillions into various government debt around the world. But we're seeing now outflows from debt, and that outflows are going into stocks to some degree and commodities and precious metals. So I don't think stocks, the problem with stocks in 1987, is a different environment, and the money flowed out of that stock market and into, I believe it actually flowed into the bond market. And so the dynamics of that, you know, were on a macro level different than where we are now. And nobody bought gold in the 1987 period. Gold peaked out in 1980, as everyone knows, in the 800 level or so, and it traded from 80 all the way through the year 2000. For 20 years, it traded down on average every year for 20 years until it got to $250 an ounce. And of course, Gordon Brown here in the UK, it was that day that he decided to sell half of Britain's sovereign gold position. I believe that amounted to 600 tons or 300 tons. 600 tons.
And he did it in, of course, a way that would guarantee front running.
Yeah, guarantee that professional traders could step in front, pick off all these orders, and make a bundle and exacerbate the downside move. He ended up selling it at the lowest prices for decades and decades. And, of course, that error, had Britain held on to their gold from the year 2000 to this year, you know, gold went from $250 an ounce. It's now at $1,500 an ounce. So that's 600% gain in your gold. It's a, I think the last I looked, it's a, it's an enormous loss of capital. And, you know, someday it's going to be comical when Britain comes in and buys gold in the open market. You know, when gold's at $10,000 an ounce, here comes Britain to buy gold. That could be the top. Whenever Britain buys gold again, the sovereign banks buy gold again, that could mark the top in the gold market.
Well, I'm not sure that there will be a top in gold or silver in our current currency grid. I don't see any of the currencies surviving. I think it's going to have to be a total brand new reset. So I don't think there's any sort of like there can't be a top in the British pound, because the British pound is going to be dead. So it's not going to go to 10,000 pounds and then, okay, that's the top, and it's going to go back down in pound terms.
You know, well, yeah, as James Turk says, he doesn't really see a top in gold or silver. What he sees is that people will start using gold and silver to buy stuff. Hmm. So, you know, you've got your gold and silver and you're using it as a medium of exchange to buy stuff. So, you know, you transitioned from gold and silver as being an investment to gold and silver as currency. And when people start to use their gold and silver after the breakdown of the fiat currency markets, that will be a new era. So you don't really talk about it in terms of trading or ups and downs. You just say, this is the money that I have and I use it to buy stuff. And you may buy at that, you know, you may decide that, well, for 10 ounces of gold, I can buy, you know, a house here in Chelsea. I can buy, you know, a nice apartment in Chelsea for 10 ounces of gold. You might decide to do that.
Yeah, or it might cost you 20 million pounds.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the dynamic. And James Turk has been probably the best in calling this market going back 10 years, 15 years. He's been very, very good at calling the gold and the silver market. I don't think he's really had anyone has done a better job in calling these markets. And, you know, things look good going forward. The British pound is, you know, is a place that is not where you want to be versus gold and silver. We've been saying that now for, you know, 5 or 6 years on this show. And by the way, I'm going to be, and we're going to be in Dublin on Wednesday, next Wednesday, the 13th. We're going to do my live show at some pub somewhere. I guarantee a genuine miracle, by the way. I'm going to be performing a genuine miracle that would force the, what do you call it there, the Vatican to recognize as one of three. After I perform three miracles, I become a saint. Wow. This will be my first miracle. I guarantee a genuine miracle. Uh-huh. So don't miss it. It's going to be in Dublin. We don't know where yet. It's a $5 optional.
€5.
€5 optional contribution to the Silver Liberation Army. But no tickets, just show up. And, you know, this will be more details on maxkaiser.com for more details, Stacy.
Anyway, so you were mentioning this assignats and the French Revolution. And those sort of histories, and that's a frequent occurrence, the situation of the population itself demanding massive printing of currency. And you see that all over the world right now. So even if you try to be, you know, a prudent sort of conservative person, say in the UK, if you don't get onto the housing frenzy, you're still, you know, obliterated by those people, because they are the most insane people dictate policy, whether it's the central bankers, but they're just responding to the insanity of the population, who then, it becomes a cycle where the population becomes insane because they have this house price that they need the nominal price to go up. So they demand more money printing in order to make it go up. But this is the big argument. This is the big flaw I see in the Alan Brown or the whole state bank movement, is because at the end of the day, you're always going to have to rely on the population itself to not go crazy.
Well, I suppose, yeah, I don't know what the big deal is in terms of preferring a limited or paper versus gold and silver. Because the Ellen Brown camp seems to think there's corruption inherent in gold and silver, and we would point out that there's corruption inherent in paper, so those two sides don't seem to come together. Clearly, I would prefer gold and silver. And there's a lot of movements afoot, you know, in states in the U.S. and in countries around the world. That people know that in Utah, they're going to bring gold back in as a currency. In Mexico, there's been now for 10, 15 years, Hugo Salinas Price has been lobbying the government, and he's a very well-connected billionaire in Mexico. He's been lobbying the government to bring back the silver coin in Mexico and to have it circulating concurrently with the paper currency. And I saw his presentation in London at the Cheviot Hard Money Conference, and he's worked out all the questions and answers, and he's got the whole thing worked out. It's a brilliant scheme to bring in. So there's and Soros, of course, his group with Bretton Woods too, they're going to recalibrate the global economy, create a global bank, and of course, as part of this new global currency, will be backed in part by gold and silver. And to get all the debt straightened out, they're going to have to mark the price of gold up to a minimum of $7,500 an ounce, formerly dollars. And then people, of course, are going to make a transition from saying gold is trading at $1,500 an ounce to saying that dollars are trading at 0.000 whatever gold. You know, it's just going to be a complete flip-flop in the mentality and the thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to see what's going to happen in the next year or two in terms of this new global trading currency. It definitely seems like we're going to have a two-tier currency system that the bottom 99.9% will have no access to this new currency, and only the nations and the people who run these nations and perhaps the oligarchs, I don't know, like, who's going to have access to these currencies that are able to acquire resources and goods from a country, but the actual participants in that nation aren't able to access that currency. It will be, I mean, you should know, you're a currency expert, like, how will these trade against each other? How can one manipulate the other?
Well, the key here is purchasing power. You know, what is your purchasing power with this new currency? And the answer is it's going to be a lot less. That's the answer. So against gold and silver, they're all going to be marked down against gold and silver. And it'll be, a lot of it will be circulating, but it won't have much purchasing power. But it'll be a way to get rid of some of the debt in that system. It'll be a way to create a global bank, which, of course, the current banking system wants to do because they can take all their debts. You know, all these banks, whether it's Deutsche Bank, HSBC, Barclays Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, Citibank, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, they've all got billions and billions of debts on their balance sheet that they don't disclose. They'd like to get rid of them. They'd love to dump them into the balance sheet of a new world bank and say, okay, the new world bank. Remember at Davos, they said they need $100 trillion in fresh credit lines to bail out the remaining bad debt on the bank's balance sheet. So you open up the global bank. It's capitalized with, let's say, $200 trillion credit line. $100 trillion of that's going to be kept off the balance sheet in terms of going to securitize all of the bad debt on the current bank's balance sheet and sell that to the new World Bank, and they're going to keep that in perpetuity. And then the banks are going to be all fresh and clean and lending out money again to everybody who wants it, except that the price of everything is going to be, you know, 500 or 600% higher. So the bank, you'll be able to go to Citibank and say, hey, Citibank, or you go to Barclays Bank, and up until now, you know, they've shut down their credit lines. But now under the new system, they'll be like, oh, yeah, you want to borrow 10,000 pounds, or you want to borrow 10,000 of these new global currency units? Great. Here, yeah, have 10,000 of them. No problem. What's the cost of a loaf of bread? Oh, about 50 pounds a loaf. What's the what's the cost to fill up your car with petrol? Oh, about 400 units of this new value. Yeah. So everything, purchasing power collapses. The banks will be open again. They're making the same margins they were making before, 20, 30%. You know, they're still making the huge bonuses. It's the same thing. It's just bigger, more dangerous, more insidious, and destroy purchasing power, destroy wages, destroy everyone who's not part of the top 1%. And this is where we're going. The gold and silver is a barrier to this. If the people take all the silver off the market, which they're perfectly capable of doing, there's only 30 billion of silver available in the market. There's only 500 million ounces available in the market today. The global community could take it all off the market in one day. This is what this million ounce march is all about. That's being started at millionouncemarch.com and silverliberationarmy.com. It's a million ounce march. There's 10 million 10th of an ounce silver Kaisers being minted so that the entire globe can participate in sucking the silver out of the system, which gives you the wealth, and it puts a big stop sign to the globalists.
Well, yeah, the stop sign, okay, because it reminds me of Karma Bank and boycotting Coca-Cola as a strategic boycott in order to protest the corruption of the system. And this is a very similar thing, is like, it's the most vulnerable of the multiple corrupt markets, whether it's the, you know, the New York Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange or the currency markets or, you know, any, or the bond markets. It's the most vulnerable to making our voice heard of that we do not want corrupt markets where oligarchs tip it to steal our wealth. So it's a good way to target the entire system of corruption.
Yeah, that's right. It is in the Karma Bank thinking, because going back a couple of years, Karma Bank, which of course at the beginning of the show, it says Karma Bank. You know, Karma Bank was the sponsor of this show for years, and, you know, we talked about that incessantly for a year or two, about the fact that we had figured out that the vulnerable spot in the global corporate kleptocracy was Coca-Cola. They were vulnerable to a global boycott that would crush the stock down to zero, and that would be a major win for activists pushing back against corporate occupation. The problem with that campaign is that it required sacrifice. People had to stop drinking sugary drinks. And this was too much. This was beyond the ability of most people listening to this show, who are now totally stoned on some wacky weed. So to try to get them to stop, you know, going to the corner store to pick up a liter of sugary, carbonated, caffeine drinks was virtually impossible. Now, why this Silver Liberation Army Million Ounce March is working is because it appeals to something else everybody can readily appreciate, and that is greed. In other words, the more silver we take off the market, the higher the price of our silver goes. You know, it's great that on Alex Jones, on the 11th of November, when we launched Crash JP Morgan Buy Silver, price of silver was 26.5. Now it's almost $41. Everyone who joined the Silver Liberation Army 3 or 4 months ago is making a staggering amount of money in a very short period of time. And this is going to continue.
Well, they're not losing all their wealth as well, as the dollar has sunk from, well, I think it was about 70.
Well, you get a price signal. You know, when you get the silver price hits a new high, that's a signal that you're winning. Yeah. With the Coke campaign, as the value of the stock price went down, that was the signal that you were winning. But that concept is beyond the reach of the pot smokers on this network. So they couldn't comprehend the idea that lower price meant winning, duh. Okay, so that was beyond, forget it. So now we had to go back and break it down to, okay, higher price means winning. Okay, I can get that. It's silver. You own it. It's in your pocket. It's worth more every day. Okay, get it? Okay, great. And so, you know, he forced me to actually have to work and come up with something that would work even better. You know, I'd rather be playing golf. But no, I was forced off the tee, forced off the greens to strategize a new global campaign to, you know, mobilize the global insurrection in a way that would force the bankers into submission. And voila, now we've got the winning combination.
The fact that while you were talking about Coca-Cola that whole time, okay, I was thinking of a chart that is now out talking about like consumer dollars, where they're spent in the U.S. economy. And they break it down by men and women. And this the thing that was so staggering to me was that men, in terms of industry size, for example, the water industry in America, bottled water sells $15 billion annually. That's the size of it. And that's bigger than the cereal industry, which is $13 billion. But one of the biggest industries for consumer goods is sugary drinks, soda. But even bigger than that was golf.
Really?
Yeah, I was so confused. Look, I kept on having to look at it and find the information about it. How is it so big?
That doesn't make any sense.
I know. Okay, well, you brought up golf just after talking about it.
You're saying the golf industry is bigger than the soda industry?
Yeah. Well, who knew that golf is such a big industry? Here's how the American man spends money. So if you look at this chart, it's saying the golf industry is an almost $80 billion industry, whereas soda is about $76, $77 billion.
And what's number three?
Number three, way down here, is cigarettes at about $45
billion. Uh-huh, keep going, keep going. What's after that?
Then newspapers, then beer, then bars, then radio, then gyms, cereal, shower, I don't know what that means, cinema, music, coffee shops, concerts, video games, recreational sports, plumbing, NFL, deodorant. See, look at NFL. Way down here at under $10 billion.
Uh-huh.
So the golf industry is, what, eight times as big?
Uh-huh. And it's number one. The number one expense for men in America is golf.
According to this information here.
Now, what does it say for women?
This is, I guess, from IBIS World, this information. The women's one is available. I'd have to find the link.
Then. Okay, so golf. Well, it doesn't make any sense to me, to tell you the truth. I don't see how you can spend more on golf than anything else in that chart. I don't get it. I mean, I mentioned it. Maybe I'm just in denial. I mean, as far as I know, I don't spend a penny on golf, but it could be that I'm spending a lot of money that I'm unaware of.
Well, actually, maybe they're including all the TARP programs, for example, because you always say it's subsidizing people's yachts and their golf course fees and their grounds, you know, their country club fees.
Yeah, when AIG went bust that weekend, they had a golf weekend. And they went out and they spent millions of dollars for their showering their executives at an expensive golf resort. So, in other words, if I take a trip to Hawaii to play golf in Hawaii, did they include the tea fees, and the whole trip, the airfare, the hotel, and everything is included into this golf? Or do they just include the actual balls that I'm losing as I play golf and I lose about?
They're including the tea fees and the the costs of keeping these golf courses.
No, but do they include the flight and the hotel?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
That would be the airline industry.
I would think so. Okay, let's say I lose 10 balls every 9 holes, which is about the average, my average golf score. You know, some people, they got a handicap of 10 or 18 per 18 holes. That's how many balls I lose per round. Now, okay, each ball costs $5, so, all right.
What are the average tee fees?
It depends on, well, you know, of course, you know, you can pay a lot if you're on a swanky joint,
But that's what I'm saying, is maybe this is a sign of kleptocracy and oligarchy, of genuine oligarchy, that maybe it's been 15, 20 years since you were on Wall Street. Maybe the fees have gone up to oligarchic levels, and you know, it's a way to...
Well, of course, you have to water the golf courses, and the price of water is skyrocketing. I remember back in the 1980s, during the go-go 1980s, on Fridays, me and my buddy used to catch the shuttle flight from LaGuardia in Manhattan to Nantucket Island and get on the Nantucket golf course in time to play 9 holes and then get to the cable car, which is a nice bar in Nantucket, in time for sunset, you know, and then we'd hang out on his yacht, which he had moored in Nantucket for the entire summer season. So it's a nice way to start a weekend. You put in a few hours down at the job, cranking out some commissions, and then you head over to the golf course in Nantucket.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. So that was in the late 80s, early 90s, and here you're having record-breaking annual bonuses for bankers. So yeah. Is this a representation of that? So they're saying it's an $80 billion industry. No wonder Tiger Woods gets paid $1 billion. I always wondered how they've got all that money to give to him. But
well, maybe the golf balls are made out of pure cocaine. And it's some kind of way to move blow around the economy. I should be snorting these golf balls instead of hitting them.
I see your brain like working overtime right now, going, how do I get in on this golf industry?
I've been losing these golf balls. It's probably like 40,000 bucks a smack per every ball I'm losing out there. It's wild. I'm losing incredible amounts.
Anyway, I'll post this article on our site. And I just don't have time to do the investigation on this at the moment, but somebody else can...
Well, I told you that story about that public golf course I was at around the same time back in the 80s up in, I think it was Pelham or the Bronx or someplace. And we're playing golf with my buddies on some afternoon. And this group of kids storms the fairway and they charge us and they steal our clubs. And I'm thinking, well, what's the penalty for that? Two strokes, three strokes? Stolen clubs on fifth fairway by hooligans.
How did they hold you up? Did they have a knife or a gun, or did they?
There was
just
a lot of them. We're out there in our freaking, golfing shoes and outing, drinking some nonsensically cheap beer or whatnot. And here comes this gang of thugs come out, and they robbed us of our clubs.
Dear. Is this one of those stories that was actually like 2 12-year-olds and then the recounting of it is like, oh, there was a whole like gang of these big, giant, angry guys.
Well, it definitely put a dent into the festivities. I'll say that, you should watch your golf clubs running away,
So you see, well,
these are the ping clubs, and ping, when they first came out with those nice ping clubs, they're expensive,
So, well, obviously it is a big industry then.
Those golf clubs, they got the Bertha, Big Bertha. They got all these customized clubs. I think these clubs, I see golf shops here in Paris. I'm wondering, how can they stay open? I guess people go in there and they buy these.
Obviously it's a big industry.
They buy these custom clubs, drivers. That costs like 1,000 euros for one frickin' golf club. And it's stupid because a golf club has nothing to do with your golf game,
I'll have to ask Tiger Woods about that because I don't believe that.
It's like putters. People buy all these expensive putters when, it's not going to change your putting score whatsoever. I mean, you got to just actually go out there and golf and improve your score. If you get a 5,000 euro balanced putter, the gyroscope or something, it's not going to change your game one bit.
I'm looking at online to find the best golf club. See if there's such a thing.
It's a golf industry. Obviously, they're propagandists. They're spreading the word that you need to buy an expensive golf club. No way. It's all nonsense. You can. Same golf clubs I had in 1960s when I was you know, a child, I'm sure I could golf as adequately as I can now. They were made by Ben Hogan. The Ben Hogan series of clubs, I think they cost $50 at that time for a whole set.
How much? $50?
I think.
Well, see, like Adam's idea, Pro Black CB1 irons. They're listing the top 10. So they go from $799 to $1,000.
For what, a set? Or
for one club.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You shouldn't pay more than $50 for a club. You just use a stick. You don't even, it's just, you know, they used to use sticks in the old days. That's all you need, a crooked stick.
Well, maybe we should come up with a Silver Kaiser club.
Yeah, I'm getting into this golf business. A Silver Kaiser golf clubs for $50,000 a set. This will make drop your score down to, you'll be a scratch golfer, guaranteed. I guarantee it. You buy these 50,000 Silver Kaiser golf clubs with the special Max Kaiser driver sock puppet protector, and you'll golf better than Tiger Woods, guaranteed. I guarantee it.
Well, so these all seem to be, about $1,000. So yeah. maybe if you actually had to get custom made, that would figure that it's even higher than that.
Look, for $200, you can buy a gun and blow your freaking brains out, and you'd be doing yourself a favor if you're going to be spending $1,000 to buy a customized zip club, nonsensical. I'm tired. I'm not talking about this golf anymore. I've had it. I've had it with this golf story. That's it.
Maybe Karma Bank should move their boycott from Coca-Cola to golf clubs. There has to be some sort of way to.
Well, anyway, so this weekend, of course, is Augusta, the Augusta National, which is the most prestigious event in golf in the U.S. It's kind of the kickoff to the whole season. Tiger Woods, I understand, is...
he's got his game back.
He's got his game back. He's off the lead. Yeah, I think he's in second or third off the top score.
Yeah, but I think he was down at like 30 before.
Yeah, he's zooming back. And I saw one post saying that, please, Tiger, we forgive you. But now it's time to start winning because without you, golf is interminably boring.
Huh. Well...
I used to live on a golf course, you know. I grew up on a golf course.
I know, you and Timmy Geithner.
Yeah, Timmy Geithner and I both grew up in Larchmont, New York, and my house, the backyard, went out.
You're both the same age.
Yeah, the backyard went out to the 15th fairway of the Hampshire Country Club, which my father moved to this house.
Well, you were going to say your father moved the golf course.
No, he moved. We moved to Larchmont before I was born from New York City. And he moved to this house because he wanted to learn golf. He figured, I think this is one of the motivations here to move to this house. So he moved to the house. So this is the story anyway that I heard. So then he goes to the club and says, hi, I want to be a member. And it turns out it's an all-Jewish club.
Oh, my God.
And
that's rare.
They would not let him in. Not in Larchmont, baby. Not in Larchmont and Scarsdale. So he couldn't get in because he was excluded.
Huh. Well, you know, anybody who watches Mad Men, of course, this is where Don Draper lives.
Yeah, Don Draper lives in Rye, New York, which is where we did then join the Westchester Country Club in Rye, New York, the beach club. And, of course, they have their golf club as well. There's two separate clubs. I think the golf club is in Rye. I forget, the beach club. I can't remember. But anyway, so then, yeah, then my father would play golf, you know, and it was all very Mad Men-like. I mean, that era, as you know, as I've said, I've watched the show, it's so, remarkable in all the details that are just ripped right out of my subconscious mind, all the little crackers and cookies from those days and the little touches and the little details and the phone, the dress, the way people dress, the whole... You know, so, yeah, it's remarkable details on that show.
Yeah, but there's New York City, from which much of the wealth of America is stolen through which there and around New York City, just how many golf courses are there within a 50-mile radius?
How many golf courses?
Thousands.
Well, so that's a lot of golf courses.
That's why it's such a big industry, you would think, because they're just, it makes sense to sell golf clubs to the people who are...
Well, I saw somebody this week. I met somebody in Paris here, and they're like, oh, you're from New York? Yeah, whereabouts? I said, oh, Larchmont. He goes, oh, do you know the Cherry Lawn Driving Range?
I'm like, you see?
Yeah, yeah. I used to hit many buckets of balls over there at the Cherry Lawn Driving Range.
See, only on Truth About Markets, though, do you learn about this stuff. No, it's overlooked, right? Nobody else. Even in this article, which got from The Atlantic about where men spend their money, everybody was most shocked about bottled water being $15 billion industry.
Yeah.
I was the most shocked about way up there that golf was the top. Nobody mentioned that golf was this big industry.
Right. Well, bottled water, you know, this is a horrible, horrible situation for so many different reasons. The, you know, there seems to be a growing awareness now in the global consciousness about this multi-hundred million mile pool, whirlpool of plastic debris in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just like the size of, it's huge. The size of Britain, I think, actually, is a whirlpool of plastic chum. Ground up, and all these beaches around the world, you look at them and it looks like sand and a normal beach, and then what they discover is that it's the top 2 or 3 inches is actually all plastic. It's all ground up plastic. So, and of course all the plastic, you know, and that's all bottled water. I mean, bottled water and the plastic associated with bottled water, and the fact that it used to be a utility, completely available, safe to drink, good stuff, has been destroyed through the war profiteering and kleptocracy and the nonsensical move away from the common good and the commonwealth toward the corporate bad and the corporate klepto. It's tragic, really. I mean, water should not be bottled water. Right, come on, give me a break. This is
tragic. I used to drink it in Los Angeles because what happened is in Connecticut we had our own well. And it was always really fresh and clean and blah, blah, blah. But in Los Angeles, most of the time, water would come out of our pipes and it was kind of rusty. I don't know if it was our apartment building or the water, but it was like kind of brown, a little bit brown.
That's okay. This could be a special situation, a unique situation.
So I would drink bottled water because I was afraid to drink the tap water.
Yeah, well, the fear is a motivator to get people to do silly things like buy bottled water.
Yeah.
To run up credit cards enormously. So speaking of tainted water and tainted food, it looks. What do you want to talk about? Fukushima?
Well, we only have like 2 minutes left.
I got a tea time in a half hour down there at the Paris Country Club.
Did you see the video that Zero Hedge posted of these two young guys who got one of the, what do they call the radiation detector?
Geiger counter.
They got a hold of one of those and drove as close as they could to Fukushima. They just drove up to the area.
Oh, yeah.
And you see their journey, and basically there's a lot of collapsed bridges, so they just have to stop and take another route. And they come into these little towns, and there are all these already feral dogs running around, these abandoned dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Or their family, you know, the owners have been washed out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
But the Geiger counter is going off more and more and more as they get to the towns around Fukushima. And it was something like, it got up to almost 400 times government safety levels.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And this is within this zone.
You remember that children's book? It was called like Mrs. Piggly Wiggly and her Geiger counter?
Yeah.
What was her name though? Piggly Wiggly, no.
Something like that, yeah.
Piggly Wiggly, of course, is a supermarket chain in the South in America.
Never heard of it, but...
The Piggly Wiggly? Never heard of the Piggly Wiggly?
No.
No, it's a supermarket chain in the South. They got a cute little pig, you know, the mascot there. And everyone down South knows the Piggly Wiggly.
I've driven through the South twice. I never noticed the Piggly Wiggly. I noticed a lot of Dairy Queens.
Look up the Piggly Wiggly, man. That's a place you got to go to get your groceries and whatnot now that they're 5,000 times higher than they were. They're going higher, too. Much higher. Much higher. People are freaking out about the price of food and energy. And they're also freaking out because people like Ben Bernanke will get on TV and say he's concerned that there might be inflation. He's not sure of it himself, but he's heard stories that there might be inflation. Meanwhile, people are dying because of the price of food and energy is skyrocketing. And, of course, we could talk about why he's deluded, but I think we're getting out of time.
Well, that's like, to close it, to say, remind everybody that Ben Bernanke suffers from the American disease of the Norman Bates syndrome. So Norman Bates did warn people that my mother might harass you. She's an evil bitch.
Yeah.
But obviously he should have known because he was his evil mother.
Yeah, of course, if I said the B word, I'm getting spanked right now. And I'm being discriminated against. I'm discriminated against because I have a
Okay. Well, say your.
Oh, bye, y'all.